Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. On this week's show, we talk to educators about the challenges of distance learning during a pandemic and the struggles of reaching students who have no internet access. We also hear from students about how their lives have changed since the coronavirus. But first, we're going to take a look at an ICE detention center in Bakersfield, where social distancing is nearly impossible. It's why lawyers are pushing to get their at-risk clients out before they get sick with COVID-19. FM89's Mari Bolaños tells us about one woman's unexpected journey.
Sofia Bajena Ortuno is 64 years old. She's been a farm worker in Kern County for 20 years.
Por mis hijos he sido capaz de hacer.
I did what I had to do for my kids. They accused me of entering this place illegally, but it was for the good of my family, the good of my kids, to give them a better life. She suffers from underlying health conditions that make her a high-risk candidate for COVID-19.
Las condiciones que tengo es...
I have diabetes. My toes are infected. I've been getting more and more headaches. ICE detained Sofia in October when she was on her way to work to pick yams. She was in the passenger seat of her coworker's car when they were pulled over.
Pensamos que era el Cherry.
We thought it was the sheriff. My friend asked, why are they pulling us over? But they didn't answer. They just asked us for our license and registration. Eventually, Sofia realized they were with ICE. We were nearly in tears when we realized it was them, because we knew they had been making rounds and detaining all of the people. ICE arrested and detained Sofia during a traffic stop. Since then, she has shared a room with about 50 other women at the Mesa Verde Detention Center. Based on what she had seen on the news, she feared contracting the coronavirus or spreading it to other women.
Era el temor que yo tenía.
I'm sad and stressed what to think. If I was to get sick there, I might contract the virus. Or if someone infected with the virus were to come in and give it to me, then I might give it to other women. Sofia says ICE continued to bring new people to the center. The women slept in bunk beds that are very close together. The ICE officers did not wear masks or communicate safe practices either. They never told us anything. We just talked about how scared we were among ourselves. But they never said, you need to cover up with something. They themselves came in and left every day and did not wear any mask. They had no added protection. When Sofia's lawyer learned her underlying conditions and age made her a high-risk candidate for COVID-19, he quickly put in a request to get her out of detention.
I actually got a call from ICE telling me that they were, like, looking into this and that I would hear back from them. I then, like, learned more information about her health. It made me even more concerned, so I, like, filed a subsequent request, like, later that day. And then I never heard back from them.
Judah Lincoln has represented Sofia since she was detained thanks to family members who worked hard to get her a lawyer. He's since teamed up with other lawyers and organizations, including the ACLU, to file a lawsuit in which Sofia is the lead plaintiff. The lawsuit demands the release of 13 at-risk immigrants from two ICE detention centers, Mesa Verde and Yuba County Jail.
As soon as we filed the lawsuit, or told the opposing counsel that we were going to file a lawsuit and listed the plaintiffs and their A numbers, it appears that's what ultimately moved them to release Sofia.
Sofia was released hours before the lawsuit was made public, but she says officials did not give her an explanation. I didn't understand what was going on. For me, it was impossible that they let me go, just because. But I think they were scared that I would get more sick. Sofia remains the only plaintiff on the case to be released. She is staying with family while she awaits her follow-up appointment with ICE. I'm still worried about contracting the coronavirus, given my health. But I'm very happy to be able to be with my family again, and to live with them, even if it's a bit restricted. ICE did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The ACLU is now asking for the release of 24 more at-risk people detained at Mesa Verde, including a 74-year-old man who was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Mari Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. School districts throughout the Valley and statewide are grappling with how to keep students engaged in learning when schools are closed. To find out how the transition to distance education is going, I spoke with three leaders from the Office of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools, Superintendent Mary Barlow, Deputy Superintendent of Instructional Services Lisa Gilbert, and Chief Technology Officer Anthony Davis. Also joining in the discussion from Fresno Unified are Chief Information Officer Nikki Henry and Chief Academic Officer Kim Meckham, Fresno Teachers Association President Manuel Bonilla, and EdTrust West Executive Director Alicia Smith Arrilaga round out the panel. Thank you all for being with us today. You have definitely are going through challenging times, and so we appreciate you taking the opportunity to fill us in on what's going on in education. So, Nikki Henry with Fresno Unified, I'd like to start with you. How is the district using technology to continue students' education at this very, very unusual time?
Right. Thank you so much for having us. You are absolutely right. These are unprecedented times, and we have been working day and night since before the decision was even made to close our schools to really figure out how we can continue our learning while campuses are closed. Our amazing instructional team under Kim Meekham, Chief Academic Officer, who is also on the line with us, they had a full online learning platform with curriculum, resources, activities, daily recommended schedules. They had that up online Wednesday, March 18th, just 2 days after we went into school closures. That's delineated by grade level, also provides for our early learning, our alternative education, our special education populations, our dual immersion, and others as well. So that was the first step, was making sure that our kids had a curriculum to continue their learning, because our education system is not just about grades. It's not just about state testing. It's about our kids learning and growing as individuals and as citizens as well. So that was step number one. Now we've shifted into really diving in to ensure that all students, every single student, has access to a device so that they're able to engage in that online learning. And we're also diving in deep on the internet access available to our students. We see that about 10 to 15% of our students don't have access to the internet at home. And so we're doing everything in our power to try to get those devices in their hands and get internet access to them as soon as possible.
And how are you getting internet access to them?
So internet access is the trickier part, to be honest. We're very grateful and lucky that our board has led us to where we have almost enough devices to get devices into the hands of kids, all kids, within the next few weeks, over the next month or so. But on hotspots, that's much harder. So we have teamed up with the 1 Million Project and have already gotten out 950 hotspots to our students. Specifically, our high school students are being prioritized. And those with the greatest need as well, including our students who are living in shelters right now. So we have gotten 950 out, and we plan to have another 9,000 out through by the end of summer. But that's the harder part. And so we're very excited to learn more from the governor's announcement yesterday with Google providing 100,000 hotspots across the country, and how we can tap into that. So we're moving in live time on that, but it's definitely trickier. We're also making sure that we get the resources to our families around the Xfinity free Wi-Fi hotspots across the city, which there are hundreds and hundreds, as well as low-cost internet through Internet Essentials.
So we've just heard a bit from Fresno Unified about how they are using technology to reach students. I'd like to turn now to the Office of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools. Superintendent Barlow, I understand that approximately 40% of your students do not have internet access or computers at home. So how are your districts continuing to provide instruction to students using technology?
At the beginning of the COVID-19 school site closures, we provided hard copy packets to all 190,000 students K through 12. They were developed through the expertise of the professional learning department at Bakersfield City School District, and they covered English language arts, mathematics, as well as English language development, and had access ability for students with special needs. These packets were then distributed and copied by many of our internal print shops and external businesses as well, as we rushed to put them in the hands of students. At the same time, we had districts that already had one-to-one devices, and they were able to deploy those devices to ensure that students had instructional materials available to them so that they could continue their learning during this time. Over the next two-week period, we were able to assess the needs of the 47 school districts in terms of connectivity and devices. And in that approach, we were also able to start ordering and acquiring what was necessary to distribute on a countywide basis to those students who lacked both devices or connectivity. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Anthony Davis to describe that process. But in terms of instructional practices, I can share with you that there are some extremely innovative ideas coming across from our instructional team here at KCSOS under the leadership of Dr. Lisa Gilbert. And we are working with many different organizations, not only in Kern County, but across the state and the nation. And so I'd like to first turn it over to Lisa to explain the instructional practices that we're using to deliver quality education to our 190,000 students.
This is Lisa Gilbert, Deputy Superintendent of Kern County Superintendent of Schools. We have approached this crisis with the goal of continued learning for all students. And so one of the first issues that our districts have been dealing with is the issue of equity, access to devices and connectivity. And as Mary said, Anthony will be able to share his excellent work related to working towards that access for all of our 190,000 students. On the instructional side, we did a lot of research around what digital learning platforms were out there and available. We really wanted to create a one-stop shop, if you will, for our district and teachers. Realizing that this is a significant shift for many of our educators, we are really trying to make it very user-friendly. And so as a county office, we partnered with Canvas, which is a digital learning platform, and they graciously allowed free access for all of our students and educators throughout our county. And so we began building out digital lessons and creating a framework that our districts could utilize, again, with the goal of us as a county office doing as much of the back-end work as possible. So as it stands, we are working with our districts to get the student data information and staff information so that we upload into the digital learning platform all of their classrooms, and they'll all be done. So teachers will just be able to log on and begin learning the platform. In addition to that, we have had a tremendous effort. We have refocused my entire division's work on supporting our districts during this crisis. And so have a large staff, along with district partners, working on specific lessons being developed and available so that, again, when those teachers log on, they have ready-made lessons available to them. Mary mentioned we focus on English language arts and math, as well as English language development. We are also expanding that work to include our history, social science, and social-emotional learning curriculum.
I'd like to bring in Manuel Bonilla. You're the president of the Fresno Teachers Association. From a teaching perspective, what are you hearing? How are teachers making this transition to distance education?
Yeah, thank you for allowing this forum. First of all, thank you to all the participants here. I think that, you know, teachers are used to adapting. And so, unfortunately, this means in this unprecedented health crisis, they're having to adapt a lot quicker. But I feel like I have to repeat over and over to everybody that this is completely unprecedented. Nobody knew to what level we would be facing. And so teachers are finding ways to do what we know to be true about education, and that is to connect with our students, to give them the learning opportunities that they deserve. And that's really kind of what's bubbled to the surface is these literacy opportunities. Again, with this idea with the primary connection, just the humanity of this crisis and just having a connection with our students and our families. And so we had a lot of teachers that have learned on their own in regards to Zoom and other platforms that are going on. And then recently having a collaborative relationship with our school district in Fresno Unified to give tutorials on how to use the apparatus that is structured in place for our district, which is Microsoft Teams. And so teachers are being creative, right? You've seen it probably in the news, everything from Read Alouds. As an organization, we partnered with PBS to do Read Out Louds and a reading room on a daily basis. You had teachers that gathered to do parades in order to, again, connect just on a human level with their students and to see them again in some fashion. So there's a variety of things that teachers are doing, and it warms my heart to see a lot of that. And I know that there are calls for, well, what are we going to do as far as more detailed instruction and those types of things? And that's on its way. Our district has done a good job to centralize some of that approach. And so what's happening, as Nikki has previously mentioned, those learning guides, daily learning guides, are available online. And teachers are able to utilize that as the primary curriculum and then to supplement that to however they feel will best meet the needs of their students, right? So the creativity is just absolutely amazing, and just the sharing of resources and the sharing of learning online has just been absolutely amazing in the response. And it's not just locally, it's a national response, right? Teachers just sharing different resources, again, with the primary focus of just connecting with our students.
EdTrust West Executive Director, Dr. Alicia Smith-Arrilaga, is here on the phone with us. You have done quite a bit of research into the impact of distance education on vulnerable student communities. Obviously, districts didn't ask for this and are doing the best that they can in these very, very strange times. But based upon your research and your understanding, how does distance education impact vulnerable students and families?
Just like the previous speakers noted, we're definitely in unprecedented and uncharted territory. And I think, you know, many districts across the state are really trying to rise to the occasion under very stressful circumstances to respond, which has been really hopeful. And, you know, even with that, I think we know that before COVID-19 happened, we already had very huge gaps in terms of what students had access to equitable learning opportunities. And one of the things that we know about distance learning and many of the pieces that folks are very diligently working on around access to technology, access to internet service, we know that those divides really break down along lines of race and class. and language status, and that that can be really problematic in terms of whether we end up seeing gaps widen due to the fact that so many students are learning through distance learning measures right now. And, you know, because of that, one of the things that's going to be really important is really thinking about, and one of the things that's also been heartening in these past few weeks is to see, just as Manuel mentioned, the really creative things that people are doing, how people are sharing resources, what folks are learning are actually really successful things in terms of keeping students engaged. And those are techniques that I'm really hopeful that as a state and as districts, that once we learn what those things are, especially for students that are English learners, students with disabilities, low-income students, that we can really start to think about, well, what does that mean for when school comes back in session? How do we ensure that we have a plan based on what we're seeing works now? Because we also know that it's likely that this could happen again in the fall, given that we don't know how COVID-19 will proceed. So how do we make sure as a state that moving forward, we're fully equipped for learning to occur, whether it's in person or virtually, and that every student has equitable access, will be important things, I think, for us to be considering in the weeks ahead as well.
Great. Thank you for that. I would like to come back to Fresno Unified. You know, we've heard from several teachers who've said there will not be any more grades given. If that's the case, how will next year unfold? And what will this mean for teachers next year in terms of the kind of catch up they're going to have to make academically with their students?
I want to bring in Kim Meekum, our Chief Academic Officer, on this as well to dive a little bit deeper. But I do want to start with just sharing, at this point, our decision on having our learning resources being optional is about equity. And we know, just as we were just hearing, the inequities that can exist for our students, especially when it comes to distance learning and to access to the internet and devices. And we know how those things can compound and intersect for our students as well. So we want to make sure that during these school closures, that no child or student is harmed academically by these campus closures. Campuses are closed, but learning continues. And so that's the reason why at this point we are not grading anything, but we are continuing to wait for guidance from our state and talking through what that grading looks like. And I want to pass over to Kim Meekum, our Chief Academic Officer, to expand on that.
Thank you. CDE, as we all know, just came out with some guidelines that for the state, and they had a focus just like most of our districts have, which is around our, you know, upper class students, our seniors, and looking at the impact on them for graduation, our juniors through the A through G going into college, and sophomores in their planning year. So looking at their guidelines, and then as a district, fortunately, Jim Evino, who's our county superintendent, has really just done a great job with our superintendent and other superintendents on the Valley, Central Valley. And they've been meeting consistently to really discuss and learn together and also try to calibrate as much as possible, knowing that the impact on all of our families across the Valley based on our decisions. And so we're in that process in terms of just the, like, how this is going to look. There's multiple decisions that are laid out in the CTE. We've explored those in terms of kids opting into independent study. We are looking at the pass-fail or the grade, the third quarter grade, but we're not there yet. We really are going through a process, a very intentional process, knowing that the impact that you've heard really from the last three speakers, Manuel and Nikki from Fresno Unified area, as well as West Ed, I think, speaker, that there's a huge equity issue, and we know that. ZIP code does. Across our country for generations of kids has predicted a lot of outcomes, and that's not about the students and the families. It's really the design of our systems and our structures. So we're closely looking at that impact on kids and knowing it's a historical moment at the exact same time to really get back to the genesis of learning and why kids love to learn, why we love to learn. We are all curious beings. And so the whole idea, Manuel and I have talked about this as our organizations continue to ensure we are together and thoughtful in embracing this opportunity to really think of disrupting inequities in our organization that have existed for a long time. And so we're going to take the opportunity, embrace a chance to really step back as people and leaders in the system for our kids and families to ask ourselves, you know, is the grading process, is that what we're going to focus on? Or do we want to look at that, but really come back to how do we learn and how do we set up really the learning environment that has kids wanting to be engaged? You can't really teach right now if you're not learning how to teach in a distant learning environment because you can't reach your students.
I'd love to hear from Kern County as well. Superintendent Barlow, are at this point, are assignments mandatory for students?
So I am speaking as the county superintendent and can share with you we have 47 different districts in Kern County and we meet with them daily. I can share with you that each of them has worked carefully through this process to determine how best to connect with children on a daily basis for the social-emotional piece, as well as the assurance of continued learning. In terms of grading, we just spoke this morning with our larger districts, just talking through the guidance that came out last night. And we are not in a position where a final decision has been made. They're carefully considering how that impacts students and, of course, wanting to do no harm. The most important thing is that students have the opportunity to move forward as they would have absent the COVID-19 pandemic.
Aisha Smith-Arulaga, Executive Director of EdTrust West. We are so early in this crisis, it is impossible to anticipate what the impact is going to be on educational outcomes. But given your expertise, do you have any ideas at this point on how the school closures related to COVID-19, what this could mean for dropout rates? Are we going to lose large numbers of students in this crisis?
You know, I mean, that question is actually one of the things that's at the top of our minds and one of the things that we're concerned about. And, you know, the reason for that is just what the research already shows in terms of summer melt that already happens, disproportionately so for students who already have the least access to opportunity. And right now, you know, what we're facing is really a summer melt situation for a prolonged period of time.
And just explain what the summer melt is for people who are unfamiliar with that term.
Sure. So summer melt is a term that refers to, you know, what happens for all students in the time between the end of the school year in the spring and then when school starts again in the fall and not having that instruction over that period of months. You know, the things that students forget or come back and need to relearn or reengage. And we know that those gaps in learning, if students aren't doing enrichment activities over the summer, can be larger for some groups of students than other groups of students. And so that's why the measures that are being taken now in terms of, you know, just regular contact with students, engaging with students in all different kinds of ways is really important. And then moving forward, it's also going to be important to think about, you know, how do we prevent some of the dropout we might see by, do we need summer bridge programs? Are there ways that we want to be thinking about engaging with students differently over the summer than we have before? I think one of the things that's come up consistently in this call has been an opportunity for innovation. And I think we really do have an opportunity here to think about really out-of-the-box ways to be engaging with students over the coming months to ensure that we don't see dropout rates that we could if we don't have a plan for thinking through how we engage and keep students engaged.
That is perhaps a silver lining. Educators are forced to be creative at this time in order to keep students engaged. And so as the president of the Fresno Teachers Association, Manuel Bonilla, what are teachers' biggest concerns right now? What are they most worried about?
Yeah, again, kind of going back to that, what we know to be true about education, about anything really, is this idea of relationships matter, right? Relationships are at the core of what we do. And honestly, when our board voted to extend the school closures through the remainder of the year. The overwhelming response that I saw from educators publicly is this feeling of mourning, mourning of the loss of the school year, mourning of the loss of an opportunity for closure. However, the silver lining in that is now that that decision has been made, people can go through that grieving process and then really focus 100% of their attention on the distant learning implementation that's going to be taking place. And then in regards to like just the that's the more adaptive components, right? But the technical components is just they want some direction, and not that they haven't had some direction, but just everybody looking to, okay, what is our intentionality with this? And we know that they'll be getting that in today and tomorrow from the district along with us, what to say, like, here is what we're planning. And it's, I think, a good plan in that it centralizes, again, some of the learning opportunities for teachers. So not only do you get to learn from, you know, district leadership in regards to some distant learning platform tutorials, but, again, that idea of learning from each other. There are going to be things that people that are more tech-savvy are going to be able to teach other teachers. So as those guidelines become very clear, I think that that's going to help out. And then just the idea of just clear communication, right? What is it that I need to do in order to help this situation? So that way it's not just, 4,200 teachers kind of on their own, but everybody is rowing in the same direction. And I truly believe that we're going to be there, if not in the next few days, definitely as we go full implementation mode, as we come back from our official spring break in a week.
Could we follow up with one of the bits that Dr. Gilbert has been providing in terms of support for teachers? Lisa?
It's been a high priority in terms of what this continued learning would look like to support our classroom teachers. And so we have been very focused on assisting them, just not only learning the technology, but talking to them specifically about how to differentiate instruction with for our students with disabilities, as well as our English learners. And chunking training so as not to overwhelm. So really being a partner in the journey towards utilizing technology most effectively to continue the learning for our students.
That's extraordinary. Well, again, thank you so much for all that you're doing. Thank you to all of our panelists. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, I interviewed Fresno State's director of the Center for Faculty Excellence, Brian Barrett, about how faculty and students are adapting to distance education. And I talked to a Fresno homeschool parent, Elizabeth Rooney, about how to teach children from home. You can hear both of those interviews on our website, kvpr.org. What's it like to be on the front lines of medicine during a pandemic? FM89's news director Alice Daniel got a firsthand account from Dr. Patil Armenian. She's an associate professor of clinical emergency medicine at UCSF Fresno, and she works at Community Regional Medical Center in downtown Fresno.
Why don't you take us through the ER? You know, what is it like right now? I've heard some people say it's kind of like the calm before the storm.
We are really talking about it right now, like it is the calm before the storm, because we're used to really high volumes of people. Typically in our emergency department, we see, I believe, over 325 patients a day, and those numbers are really cut down right now, I think, because people really don't want to come in if they're not... they don't really need to come to the ER. And so although we're experiencing really low volumes, all of our colleagues, north and south of us and across the country, they're already experiencing, major surges, as we all know. So in our ER right now, the busiest parts of our ER are our tent where we do COVID-19 screening and actually our high acuity areas. So those, that means the areas of our ER where we see the sickest patients.
And you said you were working in the high acuity area last night. Tell me what was that like?
I was there last night, and what I really liked about my shift was just seeing everybody working really well together. We've always been a really good team, which is one of the reasons why I work at CRMC. I love all of our nurses and techs and clerks and all of our ancillary staff, and we always work like a really tight-knit unit. But last night it was even more so because we were all getting dressed at the same time in full protective wear to go into all of our really sick cases, and then always, you know, debriefing afterwards anytime we had a really critical case. And so it was actually really nice to just, you know, realize, you know, we're all on the same team here and we're gonna get through this. And we did see a lot of sick people, people that, you know, we're ruling out for COVID-19 and may have it, but we were able to kind of really function well together as a team. And most of it is because our department has really done a lot of preparation.
Well, what are some of the fears ER doctors and nurses have about preparedness for this pandemic?
You know, our fears are on so many levels. We have fears for our patients, right? That we're not going to have enough equipment to take care of them. We have fears for ourselves and our families that we're going to get infected and then take it home to our families and get the people that we love sick, or get sick and critically ill or die ourselves. And so that comes with the fear of not having adequate protective gear. You know, what if we run out, or running out of things that we need to take care of our patients, running out of space in which to keep our patients. So it's really many different levels of fear. And so you just have to take each one, you know, one thing at a time and see, okay, how can we prepare for this? How can we deal with this? And I think we're all doing, you know, many different things just on a personal level, but also on like a hospital and departmental level to deal with all of these things. So I think one thing that we're really good at in emergency medicine is just to, you know, come up with plans and getting things done. And so we're doing a lot to like get adequate protective gear for everyone in our department, to, you know, figure out what resources we have in our hospital and in our area that we could pull from, to make sure we have enough medications, and just like a lot of fear. But at the same time, you're like, okay, I'm just gonna take each fear and figure out how do we deal with this. So, for example, you know, the fear of bringing the disease home into your family. Well, I think every single doctor, nurse, ER staff that I know at this point, we all kind of we strip down out of all of our clothes outside of our homes and then just walk straight into the shower, hot shower when we get home, and just scrub. So we all know none of your clothes and shoes come inside your house, for example, and kind of things like that. Like, so, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You have a family, obviously. Do you have children?
Yeah, I have a 2.5-year-old.
So what is that sort of disconnect like for you, going from this sort of crisis situation to coming home to this, I'm sure, adorable toddler?
Yeah, he has no idea what's going on in the world. He just thinks that we're on a really long vacation right now. And it's hard because he's not going to his preschool right now. And so when I'm not in the ER, I'm at home being mom so that my husband can work. And fortunately, he can work from home, but basically, if I'm not physically in the hospital, I'm taking care of my toddler so that he can do his job. So it's really tough, actually, and just constantly trying to, you know, be outside and stay relaxed and just stay calm and positive so that you don't let the stress and the magnitude of what's really going on you know, get to you in the home.
And you were talking about preparedness. What is a specific example of how you might be gearing up to make sure you have enough equipment, like masks?
Well, our department has been just buying up whatever gear we can find. So that's actually, it's not just our department, our whole hospital. So our hospital's been looking into like any source of masks and gowns and face shields and kind of anything you could think of, and they're just stocking up as much as possible. And then on a personal level, you know, I think a lot of us have also bought at least a few of our own N95 masks to have, just in case. I bought some online the other day just to have in case the hospital does run out. But I think right now, right now we're doing okay, but you know, we're also conserving a lot. So for example, before you would wear a mask, see one patient, throw that mask away. Those days are gone. Usually you have one mask for an entire shift. And really you kind of shouldn't be using more than that, or else we will run out.
And ER doctors see everything from shootings to horrific car crashes to domestic abuse cases, but this situation is exceptional. I'm wondering, what are ER doctors saying to each other? What are your conversations like?
Our conversations right now revolve a lot about, at least right now, because in Fresno, it hasn't hit us with the giant tsunami wave like it has in New York City, for example. So right now, a lot of our conversations with each other center around preparedness and protection. And so whether that's constantly reminding each other of, like, you know, don't forget to put your leave your mask on, or, you know, wash your hands, and just kind of things like that, to just to the bigger stuff of, like, talking to each other about how, you know, what we're doing at home to stay safe, or what we're doing to prepare, what our department is doing, how we can contribute to that. So that's kind of where we're at right now. And then we're also, ER doctors are really good storytellers. And so everybody is talking to their friends and colleagues in different parts of the country, then coming back and telling each other the stories of, this is what my buddy in New York said, or this is what's happening there, this is what they're seeing. And so that's like also a lot of our conversations of, you know, my friend in New York intubated 19 patients on his night shift, and kind of things like that, of like, these are the stories going around amongst our friends and colleagues.
And, you know, speaking of those stories, a lot of people are calling doctors and nurses heroes right now, and with good reason. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think nurses, doctors are, you know, techs and pharmacists and everyone that works on the front line in that space, in that physical space, is a hero, because they're exposing themselves to a potentially, you know, deadly disease, and still showing up for work, doing a good job, being great teams together, and really, you know, helping people when they need it the most. So I firmly believe that anybody in the emergency department setting is a hero just for walking into that place and doing their job.
Well, Dr. Armenian, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me. Thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
Earlier in the show, you heard from several educators about the challenges and sometimes unexpected creative responses to online learning. Now let's hear from a few high school and college students about what their lives have been like since COVID-19.
Hi, my name is Mia Salinas. I'm 18 years old, and I am currently a senior at Selma High School. Right now, I am grateful that I am healthy and that my family is supportive during this time, but I do feel uncertain about the future. I know that I have a bright future ahead of me, but a part of me doesn't feel completely ready to move on from high school yet. As I work towards my college education, I'm excited to make new friends and continue learning. I am looking forward to this new and exciting journey. Until then, I've definitely found myself very bored, but I try to keep myself as occupied as I can. The realization that senior year is coming to an end is what scares me the most. With all of the unexpected going on, I try to focus on other things like staying in shape, painting, and getting some fresh air outside. My personal favorite is watching Netflix or taking naps. It feels like these days go by super slow, knowing that we don't go to school, so I try to keep myself busy. Now that school has switched to online, it has allowed me to stay in touch with my teachers and classmates, knowing that the school year is not quite over yet. Along with many other seniors, I feel like I'm missing out on all the special lasts of high school, such as prom, grad night, and especially graduation. I was looking forward to the big day, knowing that we would be the first class to graduate on Selma High's new stadium. I truly hope that they can still make it happen, but until then, I'll keep my fingers crossed. Many of us had our last season of sports canceled in the blink of an eye, and it's hard to think that it's all over. No senior night, no last game, or team bonding. I was extremely excited to compete my senior season of track because I've been waiting for this the past few years. Being a leader on the team and setting big records was the goal for this season. All the hard work put in just for it to be gone so quickly. I just hope us seniors can really have the full senior experience. One thing that I wish I can get is closure. Not knowing that it was going to be our last day of high school really hurts the most because I wish I would have gotten to say bye to all my teachers and friends. These people have made such a big impact on my life, so it's hard not saying goodbye. I feel like us seniors are missing out on the recognition that senior year has to offer, and we are easily being forgotten. It is unfortunate that we have been waiting for these next couple months, and they will either be postponed or canceled. I was especially excited for prom because I did not attend last year. I truly hope that I can say that I've experienced at least one prom in high school. With everything going on right now, I just hope that we can stay healthy so we can maybe experience the fun moments of high school one last time.
Hi, my name is Juliana Mazzaliano. I am 18 and I attend Fresno State. I am in my second semester of my first year. My major is currently liberal studies to become a third grade teacher. I have two jobs. I work at Pyology Pizzeria, which is like a fast casual pizza place. And then I work at Pardini's Catering. I'm currently on my own. I've been on my own since the day I graduated high school. I do not get any money from my parents. They don't support me in any other way besides if I absolutely need help, like during this time when my boyfriend and I both need help paying rent or buying food. Both of our parents have been helping us with that. This whole pandemic has made me extremely stressful. I don't think that the people that are working right now, they don't truly understand how it feels for the people that aren't working when they don't have any money. And I also just found out that I don't get the stimulus check from the government because my mom claimed me on taxes. So it's not going to help me at all. I think that President Trump should have not signed that bill without taking into consideration the other 22 million Americans that aren't going to be getting the money because they're college students, which is super bad. That's how I feel. It's just a bad situation. I think that they were trying to save money with that, maybe. I don't know. But I'm working on a community service project with my sociology class at Fresno State. And what we're basically doing is analyzing different cases of evictions. And so when this whole pandemic thing was going on, I kind of knew how to take things into my own hands to prevent myself from being evicted. And I know the right and wrongs of eviction. If somebody were to get evicted for the wrong reason, they could possibly get a lawsuit or get a case based on the reasoning behind an eviction. So I knew from my perspective that I needed to take things into my own hands to prevent myself from being evicted and what the right process is that I could be doing. My professor sat down with me and she told me that what steps I need to take to prevent myself from being evicted during this time. It's been super stressful. I don't think that the people that are working like truly understand what's going on right now. It's just, everything has just been so stressful on my part, my boyfriend's part. Even our families have been stressed out. They're stressing out for us because we're not working. Like I didn't pay $7,000 a year at Fresno State to just sit at home. It's just totally this whole situation is so screwed up for college students. We don't get the money. We pay tuition that we're not even getting an education for now. We have to teach ourselves completely online, which is, in my opinion, it's not teaching. It's we have to learn ourselves. We have to teach ourselves. So, yeah, that's basically it.
Hello, my name is Angela Cristiano, and I am a final semester registered nursing student and president of the Nursing Honor Society at Fresno City College. Nursing students throughout the state have been displaced from hospitals where we do our clinical bedside training. The California Board of Registered Nurses requires nursing students to complete 75% of our clinical hours in person, while the other 25% may be done via virtual simulation. As of today, 16 states, including Florida, Texas, New York, and Virginia, have taken the current COVID-19 pandemic into consideration and have modified the percentage to be 50-50. In our state, this would enable 14,000 new nurses to graduate in May. My cohort needs less than 3 days in hospital to meet the current 75-25 regulations set by the BRN. To delay 14,000 nurses from obtaining licensure for only 3 days when we've been training for years is absurd. As many nurses retire each year, new nurses must continue to graduate and obtain licensure to ensure we have sufficient nursing staff, especially given our current situation. If we are unable to finish the last weeks of our program, the state will be short 14,000 new nurses now, and that number will snowball the longer nursing programs are frozen. Governor Newsom implemented an executive order on Monday for nursing students to sign up for the Health Corps to be deployed when and where we are needed. Many of us, including myself, have signed up, but some of our peers have young children and are unable to deploy. The 24,000 total nursing students in California need a way to continue our programs so that we may graduate and obtain our licensure, especially us seniors that were expected to graduate in just weeks and have only hours left to complete our requirements. I am honored to serve those in need through Health Corps, but need answers as to how I am going to obtain my registered nursing license. We are not asking for anything unrealistic. We have worked hard for many years to become nurses, and many other states have recognized their senior nursing students and are taking measures to get them working as soon as possible, while still meeting the requirements and without jeopardizing their education. As of last week, we were working 12-hour shifts weekly in local hospitals, helping doctors and nurses, but have since been displaced. We students would be honored to remain in hospital at this time so we may fulfill our requirements while being of service to our communities. Or, if our state adapts to the 50-50 regulation, then we already have met those hours and can continue on and graduate as intended. Governor Newsom is leaving the decision to the BRN, who is leaving the decision to our individual nursing programs. Everyone is deferring action to someone else, and we are standing by, unable to finish our programs and getting no clear answers. We signed up to be nurses because we are called to serve and live our lives to help those in need. We need to stay on course for the sake of healthcare in our state, and we need decisions to be made now. Again, we students have been displaced from hospitals, our programs are frozen, and we need the BRN and Governor Newsom to allow us to complete our programs to ensure there are enough nurses now and in the months and years to come. Thank you.
That was Selma High School senior Mia Salinas, Fresno State student Juliana Masliano, and Fresno City College nursing student Angela Cristiano.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together on the web at chcf.org.